This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Happy holidays. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Of course, the holiday season. And for a lot of folks, that means a trip to LAX, the second busiest airport in the country.
Carson number 6. If you have any connecting flights, please make
LAX is a gateway to the city and also a gateway to the country. For some, that gate will remain closed. Closed for those whom Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, find suspicious. Maybe their documents don't look right. Maybe they've got a temporary visa. But CBP doesn't trust them to leave when their time is up.
No, that's not her.
No, it's not. But the one that I clicked on, that's her. She's born 2562.
Last fiscal year, 660,000 people overstayed their visas, a number that's typically higher than how many people try to sneak into the United States from Mexico. But you obviously can't build a border wall at an airport. And so every day at LAX, U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers are on the lookout to try and decipher who is a bona fide traveler and who is not.
We don't know the true story. Because if we're wrong, or this person tells us, let's say that they're here for one reason, right? Let's say for vacation. But I mean, in reality, in the back of our mind, we're thinking like, oh, maybe 9/11 is going to happen again. Could there be something more? And that's always in the back of our mind.
It's Alejandro Dorado. He's a supervisory officer with CBP at the airport. And he spent a recent morning with KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, who's with us now to look at how immigration enforcement actually works at LAX. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
So every day, according to customs officials, this is a number that I saw, and it was an eye-popping number, 35 to 45,000 people arrive on international flights each day. That is a lot of travelers.
Yeah.
So what roles do customs officials play at LAX?
Well, a lot of things, actually, Steve. They review documents, of course, also go through your luggage, check for contraband, and they decide who gets to get through that gateway. But it's not like an immigration judge. Here's Jaime Ruiz. He works with the CPP Office of Public Affairs.
No one gets deported from an airport. You get refused entry from an airport.
Right, this is a border crossing.
Correct. Basically. Correct. So deportation is a legal process, and only a judge can order a deportation. We don't deport people from here. We refuse entry.
So then, Benjamin, how do CBP officers decide who should get through?
Yeah, a lot of what they're doing is looking for people who might overstay their visa. And Steve, I got a firsthand look at how all of this works. I had a lot of questions going in because it can seem random in some cases, right? Discriminatory in others. Who gets pulled aside and why? So you get off your plane, and before you go grab your bags, you wait in a long line often to talk with a CBP officer. And they ask you all sorts of questions, right? Where you've been, for how long, what you brought back. For most foreign nationals, however, the questioning is much more thorough. They might want to verify your information or some documents are missing. They'll ask, where are you staying? And for how long?
Yeah, she has been coming by, yeah.
And another really important way CBP officers evaluate who should stay and who should leave is money.
Japanese yen.
How much do you
have? Around $8,000.
And that was a man traveling from Japan with his wife and two young children. You need to prove that you have enough money for the duration of your stay in the U.S. so you're not going to, for example, stay and work here, violating the terms of your visa. And you also need to have a return ticket, confirmation of where you're staying, the hotel or the family member you're staying with. Also sitting in this secondary screening area that I was in was a man named Rodolfo Tumbaga. He's traveling with his wife and his kids.
I've been here for around, I think, 3 hours already. Yeah, we're on vacation. That's why every minute counts, because...
Have you been to the U.S. before?
Yeah, several times. I work in an American company back in the Philippines. So I've been here since 1981, been coming here back and forth. I don't know why.
Have you ever been in this room before?
No, first time.
So those two got released, but others, well, they had to be set aside for additional questioning or even get sent home.
So checking your finances or your documents, are those the main reasons that people get pulled aside?
That and also not speaking English.
Officers here, I mean, for the most part, we all speak English. The travelers don't. It's expected that they should be able to at least communicate, but when it becomes difficult, we do use the airline to translate.
And so what you begin to see is this kind of strange scene. You've got airline representatives that are translating on one side of this plastic see-through panel. It kind of looks like a bank teller window at the bank. And that's separating the CBP officers and the travelers.
All right, so people get pulled aside, right, and they're checking, verifying documents, things like that. What are some of the reasons someone would get sent home, actually sent away from the United States?
Yeah, I asked Alejandro Dorado, and here's how he explained it.
So essentially someone that has a bad visa, they committed a criminal offense, they overstayed a prior, let's say a prior stay, they've committed some type of fraud, whether when they applied for the visa or after they arrived in the U.S., or they're members of either a criminal organization, whether they're a participant or they're being recruited to be part of the organization.
Benjamin, did you get a chance to speak with anyone who was being sent home, somebody who couldn't get through those customs and border protection agents?
Yeah, I did. I met a woman from Venezuela, and we chatted briefly before she got called back in for additional screening.
Por eso yo creo que más que todo. Porque antes jamás preguntaban tanto.
She sounds pretty upset.
Yeah, she was really distraught. She didn't give her name out of fear that it might jeopardize her entry into the country. But she told me that she thought her Venezuelan nationality had a lot to do with why she was being called in for questioning in the first place. And she also told me that she worked in the U.S. during her last visit, which was about 6 months ago. And in their official report, CBP noted that as one of the reasons why she was being denied entry. And I asked her right before they called her back for more questioning what she planned to do if she wasn't admitted into the U.S.
Si no puede entrar a este país, ¿qué puede ser después? ¿Qué está haciendo?
En Venezuela sigo, pero además voy a ir. No me gusta vivir extranjero, simplemente vine a pasear.
So she told me she'll continue to live in Venezuela, but she doesn't like living there. She would rather stay here in the U.S. And she put it to me this way. There's opportunity, she says, in leaving. Now, the admissions review unit, this is the unit of CBP at LAX, they denied entry to 19 different people the day I was there. Some of the stories that they shared with me, a young woman from Russia who CBP says admitted to being an escort, so she was coming over to participate in sex work, she got denied entry. There was an Israeli national who lied on his visa application claiming that he owned property here in the U.S. And also a young man from Mexico who had worked illegally in a restaurant during a prior visit also got denied. So those are just some of the examples.
19 people out of between 35 and 45,000 people who come in every day.
That's right. So just because you get set aside for secondary screening, that doesn't mean you're going to be necessarily sent home.
What happens if you do get sent home? What if they say, okay, you can't come in, so now you've got to go back to your country of origin, right?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Officer Dorado says that for the most part, it's the airline that's responsible for you.
As an agreement to offer airlines to bring travelers to the U.S., they also agree to take back the passenger if they're not able to come into the U.S.
So airline companies, Steve, act kind of as this first line of screening when it comes to international travel, right? They're responsible for doing an initial investigation into their passengers, both when they buy their ticket and also at the gate when you check in. Where are you going? Connecting flights? You may have heard some of this questioning before. And so this is considered kind of a cost of doing business, right? If your passenger has to be sent home, the airlines generally pick up the tab. But if there isn't a convenient flight, you may have to wait at the airport, and on a rare occasion, that can be for a long time, maybe for a week. And,
they made a movie about that, didn't they?
That's right, Terminal Tom Hanks.
That's right.
So yeah, there's a room for families, others for individuals, TV, snacks, a waiting area, and for some folks, you know, they're stuck there waiting to go back home.
All right. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb with a behind-the-scenes look at a very busy immigration station at LAX. Benjamin, thank you.
Anytime, Steve.
Well, coming up, art is for the eyes and the ears, but one exhibition wrangles all the other senses, too. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We have talked a lot about different types of art throughout this past year. Pieces that you can see, pieces that you can experience. But what if you could smell an artwork, or perhaps even taste it, or hear it, or feel it in your body? Well, that's the goal of a new exhibit at the Tanya Benokdar Gallery in Hollywood. It's from the Icelandic band Sigur Rós frontman Jónsi Birgisson. And here to tell us about the sensory experience is our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, who's editor-in-chief at the Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All right, so let's talk more about this exhibit, because it sounds like it is just a feast for the senses.
Yeah. So Jónsi is very well known for Sigur Rós, right? And doing these very hypnotic, lyrical, kind of emotive music with that band. And for this show, he wanted to really pull that out sort of into dimensional space. And so we're not just listening to the music, we're experiencing it sort of in the round. And he's created these experiences that the body can situate within and smell and touch and kind of feel. And all of these senses really collapse onto each other.
So there are three separate experiences. Let's play a clip from one of the rooms. This is called Whiteout. So you closed your eyes while we were playing that. Did it bring you back to the show? What did it make you feel like?
It's interesting hearing it back, because when you're there, it surrounds you in a way that it doesn't when you're just hearing it. In the space, it's completely white. So you walk in, you put little booties on because the floor is painted out white as well. So you sort of are in this non-space. And the speakers, there's multiple speakers embedded into the walls. So even the speakers are invisible. And as you walk through, you're hearing Jónsi's voice and different sound effects kind of create this chorus throughout the room. And then in the center, there's these platforms that you can sit on or lie on, and they're embedded with subwoofers. So later in the piece, there's kind of this like thunder-like music that comes, and the music really swells. And I was laying down on one of those, and your whole body starts to vibrate with the music.
This is the feeling you get,
yeah,
right?
From the vibration. It really like pulses, and the whole room seems to be kind of shifting around you.
So you see white, you're hearing this music, you feel the vibration, and you can smell something?
Yes. So Jónsi is a perfumer, which is so interesting. He's been working with perfume for some time, and each of the rooms in this exhibit have a different scent that he's created. So in this room, it's this ozone scent. Almost smells like that smell after it rains, or just kind of really fresh oxygen.
That sounds fascinating. I know there's another room, because I mentioned three of them, but let's give another example of another room in this exhibit.
Yeah, so from the whiteout, you walk into this totally pitch black space, and this is called Dark Wave.
This is obviously someone whispering.
Very different.
What is that?
Yeah,
what is
so it's kind of this ASMR kind of thing where it tingles, right? You hear his voice, and this is Jónsi. He's breathing, and he's also reciting an Icelandic poem about the sea. And you walk into the space, it's pitch black, but above you there's these panels that are actually moving and creaking. So on top of that sound, there's this creaking sound that happens. And embedded on those panels are multi-directional speakers.
Yeah.
So in this room, you're in the pitch black. I was holding my dog.
This is really trippy.
Yeah. And it sounds like Jónsi is whispering in your ear at one point, because these speakers kind of come down at you. And in this room, the scent is sort of a seaweed type scent. So it really evokes this musky kind of ship or ocean.
The whole concept of this, what is the shape of sound? I mean, that's fascinating to me. What is Jónsi trying to evoke in this exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, he's been a musician for so long, and I think this is him just pushing it even further into kind of, as I said at the beginning, this sort of dimensional space. But I think there's almost this utopian kind of message behind this show. I mean, we think of our senses like we read a book, we watch TV, we smell perfume. These are all kind of segmented. And here he's collapsing all of them And in a way to kind of counter the multitasking of our everyday life, he's just offering this collapse of everything that creates this sort of peaceful space to have a pure experience within.
How did he get in? I mean, he's a musician, right?
So, yeah.
But how did he get into this artistic, you know, all the senses are involved here?
This is his first art exhibition. But it's really interesting to note that his family founded a store in Reykjavik in Iceland. And he started this with his sisters. It's called Fisher. And the whole store is meant to be this sort of experience. So they sell candles and tea and also Yonzi's perfume in the store. But they've created a soundscape. So when you walk into the store, it's almost like this full body experience. So I think that project really influenced what he's doing now kind of in the art world.
Is that where we're headed in the art world?
Such a big question,
right,
Steve.
Right.
The art world is interesting because it always has one foot in the past while it's looking forward. Like the art world is obsessed with history and artists that have come before and quoting and appropriating, but it's also always trying to kind of get out from under that and push forward. So it's interesting to see someone like Yonzi that comes from a music background have this kind of freedom that's maybe a little less burdened by art history.
Well, art is a broad brush, right?
Sure.
I mean, it can incorporate music. It can incorporate many different things.
Right. But I think as long as the art world is tied to commodity and sales and object and the art world makes money from these things, it's going to be really hard for artists to fully separate from an object-based practice like painting, right?
What are you looking forward to in the next year?
Oh, boy. Well, the art world kind of works on like a school schedule. So the winter is very exciting. We're like
seasons,
back to school.
Right? Yeah.
And Freeze Los Angeles, the art fair, is coming back to LA this year. So we're going to see all these satellite fairs, and also all of the galleries want to have really good shows up during the fair. So I think the next few months will be very exciting. We'll have plenty to talk about.
All right, so the Yonzi show is over at Tanya Bonakdar Gallery, right? How
yes.
long does it go?
It goes until January 9th, so you got to scoot in there after Christmas.
Okay.
And it's in Hollywood.
It's in Hollywood. You're going to have more on the blog.
Definitely.
All right, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider. Lindsay, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And by the way, you can check out more from Lindsay by signing up for her weekly art insider newsletter. Just head to kcrw.com/greaterLA. Happy holidays to you.
You too, Steve.
And happy holidays to you as well from all of us at KCRW's Greater LA. Just ahead, those morsels of food news of 2019. Turns out there was a lot to chew on. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We are, of course, nearing the holidays. Can you believe it's less than a week away until Christmas and Hanukkah, of course, starting next week as well. We are naturally taking a look in the rearview mirror at the year that was. And Mona Holmes is an editor at Eater LA and a contributor here at Greater LA on all things food. She's back with us now for the last time. I'm kind of sad about this. The last time of 2019 for you.
Yeah.
Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
So let's take a look back at the year in food and restaurants. One of the big events that happened this week is the closing of the Tartine Manufactory that was in downtown Los Angeles. Tell us a bit about what happened there, because this was kind of a big shock for a lot of folks.
A huge shock. It was this week's biggest story by far. They started this project back in 2016 and invested something around $10 million in this project.
This is the Arts District,
this
right?
is in the Arts District on the eastern part of downtown in Roe. And so what the owners, Chad Robertson and Liz Pruitt, took out this hugely ambitious project where they had a retail section, a wholesale section for their bakery. They had the Chris Bianco from Phoenix come and open up a new space, the Alameda Supper Club, a walk-up window for coffee. And it opened in late January, and it closed Monday.
It didn't even make it a year.
No, it did not.
So what happened?
Well, you know, you have to go in. You have to drive into this huge parking structure. You have to figure out which direction that you're going. Some people get lost. Some people complain about the service. You know, it's a lot all in one. So maybe Tartine was too soon for that section of town.
Another place that opened up this year was a restaurant and cafe in West Hollywood, the first cannabis restaurant in Greater L.A., perhaps even the first one in the United States.
It was.
A place called Lowell Farms in West Hollywood. You reported on that when it first opened. Have you been back, and how's it doing?
I have been back, and actually they have changed their name to the original Cannabis Cafe.
They changed their name?
They did. And the message that the publicist gave me was that they wanted to extract themselves from a well-known brand and kind of focus on the food and being the first of its kind in the country. Now, I don't know if the name change is related, but there was a lawsuit that was filed by the state of California against Lowell Farms as a grower.
Do we know what the lawsuit was about?
I know a bit about it. The state of California is suing Lowell Farms in San Luis Obispo for engaging in commercial cannabis activity without a license.
And that just was released, what, last week?
On the 13th, yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about another big story that happened in the food scene here in Los Angeles. The Michelin Guide came back to L.A. after almost a decade.
They did.
Restaurants can now vie for those stars again. How big a deal was that?
Well, I appreciated that they came back. And I appreciate that there were beloved restaurants like Naka, Providence, and Taco Maria that made the list and got appreciation from the Michelin inspectors. But one thing that really got to me was that they didn't designate any three-star restaurants outside of San Francisco. And
really?
I believe that Los Angeles deserved more than that.
On a sad note, we lost the matriarch to the Porto's beloved bakery. This is Rosa Porto, who died last week at the age of 89 years old.
I mean, everyone knows about Porto's or loves Porto's.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's no in between with that. And Rosa Porto and her family have operated this business for over 40 years. And first in Echo Park, eventually in Glendale, West Covina, Burbank.
They really branched out. Yeah.
I mean, they really branched out, and they are packed all the time. Her passing is a significant loss for me, but also all of Los Angeles.
But obviously what she created and her family
created
moves on, lives on.
It definitely lives on, for sure.
Are there any trends that stood out to you, Mona, in 2019?
Okay, the Nashville hot chicken trend is just... it. Absolutely baffles me.
I can tell you, every time we talk to Mona, she brings this up.
I just don't understand how it took hold in a city that has no direct connection to Nashville. Like, none of the people who own any of the restaurants are actually from Nashville until this week. There's finally an actual family member from the family that actually invented Nashville hot chicken who opened up a restaurant this week, just yesterday. Her name is Kim Prince, and it is called Hotville Chicken. And from what I've heard, I haven't been down yet since they opened, but there's a line out the door because people are completely digging it.
What about 2020? Any new places that you're particularly excited to check out?
In Jefferson Park, there's a Oakland-based coffee house that's opening up, and it's called Red Bay Coffee. And this represents something really positive within South L.A. because so many Black-owned businesses have been closing. Residents are noticing the changes within gentrification. But in the last 2 years, there have been a ton of Black-owned cafes that have opened up in the neighborhood, including Hilltop Coffee and Kitchen, which opened up their second location in Inglewood, South L.A. Cafe, Sip and Saunder, Hot and Cool Cafe, Haroon Coffee. All these places are all Black-owned, and they're amazing. And so it's nice to see this trend continue. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to all these little hubs that are happening. You know, there's Culver City Ivy Station that's going to have a ton of restaurants for people to check out. There's Citizen Public Market in Culver City that's going to be opening up. More food options all in one. District NoHo in North Hollywood is going to be right on top of a subway stop. Sorry, a metro stop, rather. And then we can even go back to Tartine. They're alive and well in Hollywood, but they're also opening up a second location in Santa Monica. So they're not completely dead in the water. And I appreciate that. I love them as a company, so I really hope that they succeed and do well there.
Mona Holmes, thank you for all you did for us in 2019 and talking about the big stories. And here's to 20 high five, by the way. Here's to 2020.
Yeah.
All right?
Yes, happy holidays.
Happy holidays, happy new year. Mona Holmes from Eater LA here on Greater LA. That's our program for today, taking a little breather for the holidays. But in the new year, I got to tell you, we're going to take you to the Lone Orange Grove in the San Fernando Valley. I can't wait to hear this. To a rap battle in Boyle Heights. And we're going to introduce you to the subprime car loan king of Los Angeles. All in the new year, among the many stories we're going to bring to you. Coming up next on KCRW, it is the bookworm Michael Silverblatt in just a few moments. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Share your thoughts with us as well. You have a question? Well, you can ask us at kcrw.com/askgreaterLA. Many, many thanks to Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Amy Ta, Christine Camito, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, and the inimitable Christian Bordahl for making this show possible. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays, and Happy New Year. Thank you for your ears and time. Have a great day.